the sequestration planning exercises started actually early last year.
Denali National Park prepares for the sequester cuts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the lessons learned as the village of Newtok begins its move to more stable ground.
The relocation effort is taking an extraordinarily long time, and people need to be moved now. Their community is not safe.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
$85 billion in federal budget cuts are set to begin Friday. The U.S. Senate will debate competing measures to replace the cuts tomorrow, but neither will become law. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the National Park Service is slated to lose 5% of its budget, and that would trickle down to every park in Alaska.
On a conference call Monday afternoon, Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar laid out what a 5% cut to national park spending would look like.
Reduced hours of operation for visitor centers, shorter seasons, and closing of campgrounds, hiking trails, and other recreational areas.
Salazar was joined by Director of the National Park Service, John Jarvis. Jarvis says a 5% cut means fewer seasonal workers, highly skilled workers who fight forest fires and perform search and rescues.
As a consequence, we may be reducing access to some areas because of that concern. If we can't respond, then we don't really want the public getting into trouble.
To some in Washington, the cuts seem a bit draconian. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the White House is selecting cuts that people notice.
Is it a Washington Monument syndrome? Yes, it absolutely is.
The Washington Monument syndrome, the D.C. term for cutting tourist attractions and popular government services so people take note. It may as well be called the Denali National Park Syndrome in Alaska, but it's unclear whether a 5% cut to Denali would affect the day-to-day operations just yet.
This didn't sneak up on us by any stretch of the imagination.
Don Stryker is the superintendent of Denali. He's been on the job about a month, coming north from the New River Gorge in West Virginia, but he's been with the National Park Service for decades.
The sequestration planning exercises started actually early last year.
Though it wasn't formal. Stryker says the Park Service warned him just last month he'll need to present a plan on how to operate at 95%. He was prepared. Stryker says Denali is operating at about 80% employment right now. He has not wanted to fill those positions, fearing the new hires would soon be laid off or furloughed. Stryker's 5% cut will be absorbed by the vacancies, meaning he won't hire to full capacity, but he won't need to furlough anyone either. NPS officials say that's the case for the entire state. If furloughs eventually do come, they'll need a 30-day advance notice. Stryker says Denali pumps at least $150 million into the state economy through vendors and seasonal companies like the buses that take people to see Wonder Lake.
We can't get the road open unless we have the seasonal employees that we need to plow it open. And because of the nature of the hiring process, I need to be deciding by next week which positions I'm going to be hiring, and I need to be making those job offers in order to get the people here in time to start plowing the roads.
But there's a hiring freeze. He says he needs to know which seasonal positions he'll be able to fill in about 2 weeks. Otherwise, the May 15th opening date is in jeopardy. It's unclear whether Secretary Salazar required other interior agencies to detail a 5% reduction in operating expenses. Jim Stratton is the regional director for the National Parks Conservation Association.
You're not going to fix the budget problems of America on the backs of the National Park Service. I mean, it's 1/14 of 1% of the non-discretionary money in the budget.
But if the cuts happen and Congress delays a solution, that small sliver of the budget could help Congress to act. In the meantime, Denali Superintendent Don Stryker says he's prepared to plow the road himself, but he really doesn't want to. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
When he ran for the Alaska House last year, Jonathan Kreis Tompkins visited every community in his district, knocking on almost every door. The strategy paid off. The 24-year-old Democrat won a seat in the legislature by just 32 votes. And now that he's been on the job 6 weeks, it's becoming clear that Kreis Tompkins' busy campaign schedule wasn't a sprint so much as the start of a marathon. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports from Juneau.
The early morning hours in State Representative Jonathan Kreis Tompkins' office on the fourth floor of the Alaska Capitol are actually pretty calm. Coffee is dripping into a pot near the door, and classical music plays softly from a speaker as staffers Nancy Barnes, Tully McLaughlin, and Holly Smith pore over calendars and answer emails. The calm does not last long.
Good morning.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
Kreis Tompkins arrives wearing most of his suit. The jacket and tie are waiting for him in his office. There's a strap around his right ankle to keep his pants free from the chain on the bicycle he rides to work every morning. Today, the 24-year-old freshman Democrat gets to the Capitol at 7:55 a.m. with two meetings already under his belt, one at 6 a.m., the other at 7:30. Next on the schedule is a committee meeting.
So it starts in 2 minutes.
Kreis Tompkins puts on his tie and jacket and dashes down the hall to the staircase.
Are days usually this frenetic?
Yeah, I started to, there's not enough time in the building, during the business day, so I've taken to scheduling 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. morning meetings.
He ducks into the State Affairs Committee. Today, it's a presentation on the healthcare system for state employees. The rest of the day includes a Fisheries Committee meeting on derelict vessels, a minority caucus meeting, a flash mob protesting violence against women, a Transportation Committee meeting, and then visits with an official from BP and local elected leaders from Anaktuvuk Pass, Haines, Pelican, and Sitka, all of whom are in the building today to lobby their lawmakers, and about 8 hours later...
Okay. Is it right now if I... Okay, I'll just be like 3 minutes?
No problem. Okay.
After running down to the legislator's lounge for his first food of the day and then running back up to his office...
It was a very long 3 minutes.
What do you have?
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
He finally has time to sit down and talk. I ask him how holding this office compares with what he expected when he was running for office.
If I close my eyes when I was a candidate, I couldn't picture that I'd be waking up at 5:45 to get down to the 6 a.m. meeting to get to this, get it to that, and, you know, going to the lounge to scrounge some leftovers before. You know, like, none of that would have been in my mind. I never could have pictured that, unless I'd worked here as a staffer or something, which I never did.
But what's the bigger challenge to the way you're doing your job? Being a freshman or... being in the minority?
Freshman.
Why?
Everything's a learning curve. And the biggest divide in this building, from what I've seen, is not party affiliation, it's geography. It's coastal versus rail belt. Juneau is not Washington, D.C. The biggest surprise I've had since coming here, and I very consciously tried not to have expectations before coming here, is how collegial this place is. And it's surprisingly bipartisan. They're very meaningful working relationships.
During the campaign, one of the primary arguments not to vote for you was that Southeast would be giving up a lot of power if you were elected. Do you feel that's happened? I mean, how's that shaken out?
Yeah. I would argue, and I think almost everybody in this building would agree, that the biggest power shift was not the defeat of Bill Thomas, who I ran against, but the loss of the Senate coalition.
The Senate's bipartisan coalition was disbanded after Republicans won more seats in November. Kreis Tompkins says that the bipartisan coalition was also the legislature's coastal caucus. The three most powerful senators in the last session came from coastal communities, Kodiak, Sitka, and Bethel. In this session, he worries that those coastal voices are diminished. And although as a freshman in the minority, he does not have a lot of power in the halls of the Capitol, Kreis Tompkins says for now, he's just focusing on doing his job well. Reporting from Juneau, I'm Ed Ronco.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, spectators watch the FedEx jet land at Merrill Field in Anchorage.
It can't take off from the airport. They need extra room for takeoff, and they just don't have it, so it's going to be a one-time landing, and it'll never take off again.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Last year, Chinook salmon runs were so weak that the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers, along with Cook Inlet, were designated federal disaster zones. Now, a group of legislators from those regions want to create a permanent endowment that would fund research on the fish. Representative Bob Huron of Bethel is the lead sponsor of the endowment bill, and he introduced it before the House Fisheries Committee today. He says that long-term research of Chinook is needed to better understand their decline and the decline of other salmon stocks as well.
The Chinook salmon is a trend species. In other words, it's canary in the coal mine. If there's things affecting Chinook, usually it's the species that tells us that there are issues within its life environment, and the other salmon species may follow unless we do something about it.
The endowment fund would be governed by 6 representatives from different regions of the state, along with the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. That board would be responsible for awarding grants to organizations like nonprofits and universities studying Chinook salmon. The bill doesn't mandate that any money be put into the endowment, with the idea that it could be funded down the road. Huron sees the bill as being different from a research plan backed by Governor Sean Parnell. Parnell's initiative would give Fish and Game a total of $30 million over the next 5 years to examine and monitor Alaska's Chinook stocks. Huron says he wants to see partnerships with outside organizations and for the Chinook decline to be studied for a longer amount of time than one salmon life cycle.
That's where the governor and I part ways, because I'm not so sure that we want to just dump $10 million over the next 3 years.
This isn't the first time the legislature has considered creating a Chinook research fund. Huron introduced a similar bill last year before the disaster, but it ultimately stalled. According to state estimates, the economic loss to fishermen was more than $10 million. Studies by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Government Accounting Office show increasing numbers of Alaskans will be affected by floods and erosion in coming years due to rising waters and extreme weather events. And the studies predict some communities are likely to be destroyed by 2017. Of those, Newtok is the furthest along in relocating, but an Anchorage human rights attorney says changes are needed so agencies can more effectively help people being dislocated due to the impacts of climate change. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has the story.
The Yupik village of Newtok, situated between the Newtok and Ninglick rivers in southwest Alaska, is facing destruction. Rising waters and melting permafrost there have led to 2 floods since 2004. Water flooded the sewage disposal area, carrying contaminated water into the village and creating a health hazard. Stanley Thomas, Newtok tribal administrator, he says the village is losing up to 150 feet per year to erosion, and their water source is only 154 feet from the river.
And when the village safe water was doing a test, the water sources, we did pick about 3 of them, and they were already contaminated with salt water. So it's the only water source we have left. So it's in front line of the erosion. So if it's impacted this summer, how will we get our water?
Erosion has destroyed the landing where barges used to deliver fuel and other supplies, as well as the former landfill. The village no longer has enough fuel tanks to hold a year's worth of fuel. Robin Bronin is executive director of the Alaska Institute for Justice. Drawing on her research for her PhD dissertation, she gave a January 2013 presentation to the Brookings Institution. She's calling for the creation of a framework that allows agencies to more effectively work with communities that choose relocation over protection in place, a decision some come to only after protection systems have repeatedly failed. But Bronin says the decision whether to move would need to come from the community.
The controversy is that we in the world have a horrific legacy of relocations, most often forcible by governments without people making the decisions that whether or not they want to relocate. And right, we've had that history here in Alaska not that long ago.
In Nutok, villagers began working toward relocation in the 1990s. They selected a new site 9 miles away called Muktarvik. After years of negotiations and lobbying, Nutok acquired title to the land in 2003. In 2006, the Alaska Department of Commerce, Economic Development, and Community Affairs organized a Nutok planning group of more than 24 federal, state, tribal, and regional organizations, with Sally Russell Cox as its coordinator. She says the group has pooled resources. For instance, two projects have used resources from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Federal Department of Commerce, State Department of Transportation, and a Department of Defense training program. She says one of the group's biggest strengths is its collaborative approach.
I like to think of the work that we have done with Nutok especially as, in a way, following the UPIC model of decision-making, because it is definitely a group type of decision making, and you know that's definitely been what's happened. You know, everybody sitting around the table brainstorming and coming up with ideas and building consensus among themselves for how things should happen, with you know really the community being the leader and all of that.
Bronin says that collaborative process can serve as a model for communities around the world facing relocation due to climate change. But she says for Nutok to get as far as it has, it's taken a remarkable and extraordinary effort. Bronin describes other communities that have gone through an extended public process to pick a new site, only to have an agency say it doesn't meet certain criteria that wasn't spelled out beforehand. And funding is often based on population. So Nutok finds itself in a catch-22 position. It can't move to Muktarvik without water, power, transportation, and communications systems, but it can't get funding for some of that infrastructure until people are living there. Bronin says it shouldn't be that difficult.
The relocation effort is taking an extraordinarily long time, and people need to be moved now. Their community is not safe. And I know that everybody wants them to be able to move as quickly as possible to their relocation site, but there are really difficult statutory and institutional challenges that government agencies are working around.
Stanley Tom says the workload of keeping Nutok running while also writing grants, coordinating activities at Muktarvik, and lobbying for money can be overwhelming.
You know, I'm worried about the funding, the community. You know, it's a lot of things in my mind. You know, I'm worried every day, every night. You know, I have to wake up like 5, 6 in the morning and worry about my work.
Still, Tom says the Muktarvik village site now has a barge landing and 6 homes. Bronin applauds Nutok's progress. She says it's years ahead of several communities. Agencies forecast will no longer be viable by 2017. Villages that are struggling against all odds to relocate. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
A 727 FedEx plane landed at Merrill Field near downtown Anchorage at around 2 p.m. this afternoon. The cargo company donated the plane to the University of Alaska Anchorage's Aviation Maintenance Program. It will be housed at Merrill Field. The spectacle of seeing such a big jet land at a small plane airport in the middle of the city drew dozens of people to the nearby Northway Mall. The mall parking lot was directly under the flight path of the approaching jet. APRN intern Alex Duer went to watch the landing and talk to people in the crowd.
Clem Mumaugh.
Can you tell us why you're here?
Here for a historic event. Want to watch this FedEx 727 land, or at least approach the runway as it lands at Merrill Field, a historic occasion here in Anchorage.
Why is it historic?
Historical in the sense of a 727 jet landing on a field that's most small prop engine airport. So it's historic in that way. And it's also historic in the fact of an airplane being donated to UAA, their services, after it's run its service life.
My name is Frank Connor.
Can you tell us why you're here?
Well, I'm real curious about the plane landing here at the airport. Fly pretty low over the parking lot here at the Northway Mall.
This is a pretty big jet for a small airport.
Yes, it is. And the fact it can't take off from the airport, they need extra room for takeoff, and they just don't have it. So it's going to be a one-time landing, and it'll never take off again.
It's Helen Bodecker.
And you can tell me why you're here today?
Hunter and I came, my grandson, because I told him when he becomes a pilot, he would be able to work on this airplane.
Oh, okay.
So we came to watch it land.
Dick Williams. Well, I think this is a unique, interesting opportunity to see a once-in-a-lifetime landing here of a major aircraft. 100,000 pounds, I hear. It should be interesting.
Why is it unique, or why is it different from any other aircraft landing here at Merrill Field?
If not the biggest, it's one of the two biggest aircrafts to land here. There was an article that a C-130 Herc, similar poundage, about 100,000 pounds, made a brief landing once before. It's not something that happens very often. I hear they're going to make a couple flybys to get their nerve up.
Spectators talking with APRN intern Alex Duer this afternoon before a FedEx 727 landed successfully at Merrill Field. Nick Golodoff, author of the book Attu Boy, passed away earlier this month at the age of 77. His memoir about World War II internment of the Aleut village by the Japanese brought attention to one of the most obscure corners of American history. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce interviewed him last year and has this remembrance.
Nick Golodoff was born on the Western Aleutian island of Agatu on December 19th, 1935, while his parents were fox trapping.
But I was really from Attu, so I grew up to be age of six in Attu and never lived there ever again because Japanese took me to Japan when I was 6 years old.
Golodoff remembered the day the Japanese landed. He was following an older boy toward the beach when he heard unfamiliar sounds.
Alex Prusov is the one that I was following. He started running, and I ran after him, and I see pieces of mud flying in front of me. I didn't know why the piece of mud was flying till later I found out. So much later I found out it was bullets that were hitting the ground.
The Japanese occupied the village for nearly 3 months before putting the Attuans on a freighter. Golodoff remembered being in the cargo hold for the journey.
I don't know how long we've been in the ash, but when we got to Tokyo, they let us out and look around and put us back down and took us to Hokkaido.
The villagers spent 3 years teetering on the edge of starvation. Although Golodoff was among the 25 Attuans who survived the internment, he never returned to the island. The government forced the families to resettle in Atka, 600 miles to the east. Golodoff went to school there and spent lots of time outdoors.
Well, I used to hunt every day. I used to walk all day, pack a whole reindeer home from miles away. I used to leave in the morning and home at dark. Till I got a boat, I built my own wooden boat. bought oars and used to oar row and hunt with like that till I got a motor and I used to hunt all the time.
In his teens, Golodov started working seasonally in the Pribilof Islands, harvesting fur seals. Later on, he worked at the Atka Airport, and for the last 30 years was a maintenance worker at the school.
They don't want to fire me. They can't find my replacement.
Do you ever talk to the kids in the school about your experiences?
No. Some teachers want me to do that, but I can't speak in public. I'm not used to that. Never did that in my life, so I don't know how to do it.
Instead, Golodov wrote down his story with the help of his granddaughter, Brenda Maley, and National Park Service anthropologist Rachel Mason. Mason says the Yatuan story never would have been told otherwise, because the older survivors didn't talk about it.
And his perspective was different. For example, he has very warm feelings toward Japanese people, and he's pictured on the cover of Attu Boy as a small child riding on the back of a Japanese soldier. So the eyes of a child were really unique.
Mason also credits Golodov with bringing together the descendants of Attu survivors during a reunion organized by the National Park Service last year.
At one of the events of the Attu reunion, he was signing his book, and it was just such a symbol of their pride in being from Attu, and the fact that Nick, the oldest person that had actually lived on Attu, had produced this memoir that told the story of their community. So I think that it's a big loss. I'm happy that he was able to attend and to be that symbol of unity for them.
Golodov will be laid to rest in Atka. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Juneau, Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Alex DeWare from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.